see, Mr. Rodriguez, I figured we'd just start this interview. I'll allow you to talk to the voters for a second. Any listeners out there, let you introduce yourself, any qualifications you have for the job, and any background experience you have in politics.
Okay, sure. Well, my name is Junius Rodriguez. I'm the Democratic nominee for U.S. Congress in the 18th Congressional District. I am a career educator. I have been teaching for 37 years. For the past 24 years, I've been a history professor at Eureka College, and have also been actively involved in my community, serving in leadership roles in various social service organizations. I do have one previous experience in politics. Many years ago, served in the capacity of parish councilman in South Louisiana. It would be the equivalent of being a county commissioner here in Illinois. But again, that was back in the early 1980s. My interest in running for this position is because I do have a firm belief that in our citizen democracy, ordinary citizens do have the opportunity to step forward and to present ideas, present alternatives in times of need. I don't believe in the idea of career politicians. I believe that individuals should come forward, should offer what they have to the people, and should be willing to stand aside after their tenure. I believe in the idea of term limits. I have stated that if I have the good fortune of being elected, that I have no intent of serving any more than three terms in the U.S. Congress. That would be 6 years and out. I've also expressed a willingness to opt out of the congressional pension system if I am elected. I believe that the current system is something that is really out of proportion to what the typical middle-class worker experiences here in the 18th. And I believe it's a system that is unethical and creates a privilege for a few. I also have stated my intent that I will never accept a dime in super PAC money. I think that one of the great evils that we see in modern American politics is the influence that outside money has in trying to buy influence in American politics. And I think we need to do everything we can to weed that out of our system. One of the things that I would say at this point, you know, we're less than 2 weeks away from the election right now, and I am certainly appealing to fair-minded independent voters in this district. I'm also appealing to moderate suburban Republican voters in this district who are looking for a reasonable alternative, someone who represents a true desire to return to civility in American politics, a moderate voice, bipartisanship, someone who's willing to work across the aisle with Republicans, Democrats, Independents. I believe the position is truly that of being a representative of the people, not being a representative of blind party allegiance, not being a representative of special interests, but serving the needs and representing the interests of the people who live here in West Central Illinois.
So just a couple topics here that have caught my eye for the 18th District. Of course, the lack of jobs, always a hot-button issue for Illinois. What's your plan to bring in more employment to the 18th District?
I think we have to remember that the largest engine of job creation in the United States is small businesses. You know, we hear a lot of talk, a lot of folk saying that what we need to do is bring in more large industry and more manufacturing jobs. And while it's important that we do everything we can to encourage that, the true engine of job creation is small businesses. 7 out of every 10 new jobs that are created by small businesses. I think one of the things that we need to do is make sure that we can level the playing field as much as possible so that those individuals who want to start businesses and those who want to maintain existing businesses are not hamstringed by the government. And I would say that this involves making sure that we don't have over-regulation at the part of the federal as well as the state and local level. I think all too often we put a lot of the blame on federal regulation, but the truth of the matter is the state and local governments also have tremendous amounts of regulation on small businesses. I'll give you an example. Just recently I was talking to someone who owns a restaurant, and in their community, there was a fall festival, and what they wanted to do was be able to set up a booth at the fall festival so that they could basically serve their community at the same time get some advertising for their business. And they were telling me how essentially local regulations were nickel and diming them to death, and some special fees and permits and all sorts of things that they had to, that they would have had to pay just in order to participate. And as a result, they eventually opted out because they would have lost money simply trying to do something to serve their community and get a little bit of advertising in the community. So when we look at regulation, I think we have to look at regulation from the local, state, and federal level and try to make sure that we are doing everything we can to support business creation and not hamper business creation. At the same time, I think one of the things that's also closely connected to job creation is that we have to make sure that we have equitable access to educational opportunity for individuals in this district, in particular those people who are finding themselves having to find new careers when they're in their late 30s or 40s, those who realize that additional training, certificates, possibly associate degrees might be needed. And so we have to make sure that we have programs in place where we can assist those individuals who essentially have to get additional training. One of the things that we have put forward in this campaign is a proposal called Uplift in Place, in which local communities can really sort of design their own programs, utilizing local assets, community colleges, high schools, but at the same time, faith-based organizations, social service organizations, to make sure that we can create programs that will fit community needs. It doesn't necessarily have to be something designed as a one-size-fits-all government program, you know, federal government dictating what has to be done. But I think local governments, individuals working together from the grassroots, can come up with programs that can assist in terms of equitable access to education. In many respects, what I'm trying to do here is to utilize what's known as the community action model, which has often been used in urban communities to try to solve problems at the local level. I think we can do this in many of our western counties here in the 18th, where we have tremendous needs, education needs that still need to be met, and I think local solutions can help us satisfy that problem.
Sticking with education, an important topic that a lot of Illinois congressmen have been bringing up is cutting the cost of higher education. What are your thoughts on this topic?
Well, I have been involved in higher education for the past 24 years. I teach at a college that's a private college. But across the board, whether we're talking about private colleges or state colleges and universities, there have been increased costs over the years, and what we've seen is students are graduating with tremendous amounts of debt. Now, one of the things in recent years has been quite a bit of discussion about whether 2 years of free college, essentially an associate's degree, is attainable. Could federal funding basically support that? During the Bernie Sanders campaign, there was a lot of discussion about whether or not 4 years of college education could be funded. I find it difficult to believe that with our current models that a four-year funding program could be put in place. Just to give you an idea, we often look, in terms of comparison, we look at some of the European nations to see how they've done this, and Germany is one of the models that people often look at. And while Germany does provide 4 years of college education, one of the things that they've essentially done is streamlined the educational process tremendously, where there's less fluff along the way. Now, to clarify what I mean by this, if you look at the cost of higher education in the United States, it seems to skyrocket from about the 1980s on upward. And this is an interesting graph because it parallels the increase of federal student loans that came along. So basically, when it became easier for students to get federal loans, colleges and universities found a way to make things a lot more expensive. A lot of this had to do with the realization that curb appeal is very important, and so college campuses started spending a whole lot on investments to make their campuses more attractive, offering more amenities to students. They want to compete more and more. And so one of the things that happens is a lot of the increased spending is going to things that are not particularly connected to the educational quality that's being delivered. At the same time, we've seen a tremendous rise in the administrative cost of colleges and universities. Someone told me recently about a college, rather a university here in Illinois, that brags about a 15-to-1 student-to-faculty ratio, which is quite impressive. But one of the facts that they try to hide is that they have a 9-to-1 ratio when it comes to administrative personnel to students. Now this would include administrative personnel at, you know, all levels, from, you know, high-ranking officials down to low-level administrators. But still, I think one of the things that it reflects is that the cost of higher education has grown tremendously. I think if we are going to take seriously the idea of providing government support for education, whether it's a 2-year or 4-year program, the first thing that we have to do is make sure that the colleges and universities themselves are going to show some restraint, show some responsibility, and find a way to reduce the cost of higher education. At this point, I think a 2-year program in which federal monies could be used to support someone acquiring a community college degree is probably within the realm of possibility. I don't think that our current system could actually support a 4-year plan.
There are many farmers, lots of farmland in the 18th District. What message would you like to send to farmers of Central Illinois?
I think that we need to do everything we can to support our farm community, and we can do this in a wide variety of ways. One of the things that we have to remember, and I think there's been a misconception over the years where many farmers have been perceived as being contrary or being opposed to some of the ideas that we associate with environmental regulation. I think what we have to remember is that farmers are in the sustainability business. They understand the importance of making sure that their cropland remains productive, that the water remains pure. They are concerned about the issues. And I think one of the things that we have to make sure that we're doing, once again, is not over-regulating. I think that we have seen some concerns in recent years. EPA, for example, with the Waters of the United States rule, has tried to reinterpret the Clean Water Act of 1970 to essentially say that a ditch that is draining farmland is a navigable waterway, and I think that's a bit of overreach on the part of the federal government. But once again, I would say that a lot of the regulation that we're dealing with, or a lot of the concerns about overregulation, are not only coming from the federal level, but also from the state and local level. You know, every farmer basically has to have in place a standing protocol in terms of what would happen if there was, say, a fuel or chemical spill that would occur on their property. I think it's the SPCC protocol, spill protection cleanup countermeasure protocol. And these have, you know, such a thing would have to be reported to local and state authorities. So when we look at what kind of regulations are out there, I think what we need to do is look across the board at regulations that are at state, local, and federal level, make sure that we're streamlining. We do want to protect the environment. We do want to make sure that we can make sure that we are maintaining a healthy environment across the board. But at the same time, we want to make sure that our farmers can be as productive as possible. Now, the second thing that we have to connect to this as well is infrastructure improvements are going to be essential as we move forward. One of the things in this district, we've got 3 counties that border on the Mississippi River, and there's a real need for lock and dam improvements, renovations to occur. Congress has basically blocked a whole lot of this from happening because it's been viewed in context of individual pork barrel projects. On, you know, one congressional district alone, you know, seems to be wanting to get a project for itself. And what we're not doing is looking at this as a regional need. One of the things that I proposed this summer is that there's a true need for establishing a congressional caucus in the House of Representatives that would deal with the Upper Mississippi Valley, looking basically at all the congressional districts from St. Louis up to the Twin Cities and Minnesota, making sure that we view lock and dam innovations and improvements as primary to the regional economic development of our agricultural districts that rely upon the Mississippi for transporting our product, not only agriculture, but also manufacturing to world markets. I think we need to look at this as a regional issue rather than simply a district-by-district matter. And it certainly has to be one of those issues that moves us the question of partisanship. This is not a Republican or Democratic issue. This is for the economic interest of many of our districts here in the Midwest.
And finally, what final message would you like to send to voters before they head to the polls on November 8th?
If voters are looking for an independent-minded voice representing them in the U.S. Congress, someone who is not beholden to party interests and not beholden to special interests, I think that they should seriously consider the candidacy that I present. When I first entered this contest, one of the things that I thought about doing was running as an independent. And the thing that kept me from doing that is current Illinois law, election law, really does not favor the candidacy of independents. You would have to get an inordinate number of signatures, about 11,000, in order to qualify as an independent candidate at the congressional level. And without a party organization behind you to collect those signatures, it would be next to impossible for someone to do that. I am a Democrat. I've been a Democrat all my life, but I'm a conservative Democrat. What that means is I am fiscally conservative, more progressive on social issues. But my interest is in serving the people and representing the district, and not representing a partisan agenda. And so if individuals are satisfied with the status quo, if you're happy with a Congress that has an 11% approval rating, if you're happy with gridlock, then continue to vote for incumbents. You'll get more of the same. But if you believe that it's time for change, and if you really believe in the concept of change, you've got to be willing to vote that way. And so I would hope that voters in this district do give me consideration. I look forward to the opportunity to serve the 18th.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rodriguez. Really appreciate it. And we'll probably get back in touch with you closer to the election just to find out how things are going, maybe a day or two before, if that's okay.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot, Ryan.
Yep. Thanks for the interview. Appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
Bye.